From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the February 2014 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we hear from veteran Betty Webb, who did the tricky job of paraphrasing decrypted messages before they went out to commanders in the field, helping to cover up the very existence of Bletchley Park. After the war, she went straight to the Pentagon to continue her ultra-secret job. We'll hear about the intriguing and entirely coincidental family connection the director of the hit ITV drama The Bletchley Circle had with the home of the Codebreakers. And we meet Michael Portillo, former Defence Secretary-turned-TV presenter, who shared a few insights into the absolute secrecy surrounding this place during World War II, and how some people, flying in the face of popular opinion, can keep secrets in this day and age. We also take you behind the scenes at rehearsals for February half-term's exciting Living History project, where actors will help bring the buildings to life. But first, it's lovely to hear veterans being honoured and valued for what they did here in their local communities. Just around the corner from Bletchley Park, Margaret Rowland was asked to open a new wing of a primary school. She was accompanied by our Roll of Honour administrator, Jonathan Byrne.
It's just been lovely to see the children and to know that they know about Bletchley Park.
Yes.
And we just like to see the children to see what they do at school.
And it's lovely for Gerald to come here. And Gerald said the children are the heart while you're coming. And that so thrilled me, because that's why we're here.
Yeah.
The children have made coded letters for you.
Which
I'm going to show you. As you know, they've got special needs.
Yeah.
And they worked really hard.
Yes,
so
sure.
We're going to go around all the school. Mm-hmm. We're going to open up three areas of the school. The first area is the primary area.
Yeah.
And as you go forward, you'll see ration books they've made, and gas masks, and an Anderson shelter.
Oh, lovely.
And then we'll go into, as the primary area, children up to 11.
Yeah.
And then we'll move on, and there's a sensory garden. I know you love gardening.
Oh, I do.
And this garden is for children who need to relax and calm down and understand nature.
Wonderful.
We'll ask someone from the authority, Michael Bracey, an assistant director of education, to open that. And then the third area is, we're very much believe in being healthy bodies as well as healthy minds.
Yeah.
So we've bought a new outdoor gym. And an outdoor all-weather pitch, which we want to open today as well.
Yeah.
So I'll open that.
Yes, you were able to plan all that.
Yes,
then.
I was. And so we have three little openings, but we'd like you to open the area which is devoted to World War II.
Yeah, I see.
And if you did want to ask the children anything about the war, they would love it. So I'm just going to show you the first code. This is from our head girl. What it says is, so this is the code.
Yeah.
Thank you for visiting our school. To come to see, you know you inspire me. I maybe have seen you in Bletchley. I like that you're coming to visit us. You are the best woman of all time.
Oh, I thought I knew that.
And they've followed your story very much.
Yes, yeah, it really is. It's quite amazing to think, you know, that children are being brought up to that sort of thing now, and to understand what went on with codes at Bletchley Park, and it's still going on now, obviously, at places.
So that gives you a flavour for you as well of what we're going to do today. Now, have you any questions, Gerard? Because thank you so much for coming along and joining us.
Yeah. It's a privilege and a pleasure. I mean, I really enjoy myself here. I mean, it's wonderful.
But it's lovely that we can use people like your wife, Margaret, to come and inspire the children.
Yeah.
I was so pleased to be asked to open your new building. It's this really lovely place. A long time ago, I came to Bletchley Park, and I was working there, and I'm told, I believe, some of the work that I did had to do with Enigma and Colossus. So we are tied with Bletchley Park and the school. It's really lovely. So I'm very proud that what happened at Bletchley Park meant so much to the community here and all over the world, really. And I hope all at White Spire will be encouraged by that history and will enjoy learning in this lovely building. And I believe you call it the Enigma Centre, is that
right?
The Enigma Centre, that's right. Yes, so I declare this new school open.
This February half term, Bletchley Park will come to life as never before when actors take us back to February 1941. They'll talk to visitors while remaining in character, taking them deep into the story of the men and women who cracked codes at the Government Code and Cipher School's top secret HQ. The actress, cast as the Wren bomb operator's grandfather, was a bomb maintainer, giving her a personal connection to the Bletchley Park story.
So tell me, what attracted you to this particular job?
Well, it was the name Bletchley that caught my attention initially. Because my grandfather had worked here, I've always heard about Bletchley Park, and I've always just been aware of where it is and what it's about. But I'd never actually been here, and as soon as I saw the advert about the job, I just thought, I have to apply. I couldn't not apply.
And have you been working as an actress?
I have, yes. I moved to London in September, so I've been working as an actress since then. I had done other acting jobs before that, drama school and things like that, but actually fully committing to being an actor happened fairly recently.
So you've up sticks from Devon, you've moved to London and you've said, I'm going to make a go of it.
Yes.
It must be quite terrifying. Were your family very supportive?
They were, actually, massively supportive. I mean, my grandfather actually did a lot of acting and directing, sort of as a hobby, really. So he was really encouraging when I said that I wanted to move to London and be an actor. And my family are always supportive of what I do.
And your mother's not lying down somewhere with a cold flannel on her head. She'll come
not
round
that I'm
actually
aware of.
No, it must be hard to let a child of yours go and sort of enter that really risky profession, because, you know, I don't know about percentages, maybe you do, maybe you were taught that at drama school, how many actors are, you know, struggling and trying to find...
It is a difficult one. I think for my parents, probably, it was the idea of me moving to London, such a big city, and, of course, yeah, financially, whether I'll be able to survive, but I think the word that my mum used to describe me was tenacious, and she knows that I'm very determined, so whatever happens, they think that I'll survive, that I'll make it, so...
Well, you had to try. If you've got that burning ambition, I think it's worse to wonder if it might have worked out.
Definitely. And I mean, I've done other bits and pieces before this, different kinds of jobs and different kinds of careers. And this is the one that really drew me to it a lot more than anything else. And I thought, you know, you get to the point where you just think you have to take a chance. And so that's what I've done. And so far, it seems to be paying off.
So tell me about your character.
Well, I'm playing a Wren, so I'm quite upstanding, quite straight-laced. I follow the line, and I'm not really one to waver or go for any hunting for mischief or anything like that.
They're a bit posh, the Wrens, I think, aren't they?
Yes, definitely from a very well-to-do background. I think Daddy pulled some strings to get me this job, and I think it's been a bit of adjustment for my character to settle into life here, because I'm used to, you know, a good life outside. I think to come here and be in such a different environment, it's probably quite difficult.
I hear the basic training was utterly gruesome as well.
Yeah, and the...
reading about that.
Well, exactly, and the working... I mean, not that the working conditions are bad, but the shift patterns, working the night shifts, and that sometimes you're standing for the full 8 hours.
It's pretty grueling.
Very exhausting. I think some of the girls sometimes found it very demanding, difficult, and they had to go to sick bay and things like that and rest for a few days. So I think it was quite a difficult job to do, and I hope that I can embody that, really.
Can you describe how you will engage with people, how you will perform?
It's difficult to say at this stage because we've only started the rehearsals today. So what we've been doing so far is just kind of getting an idea of what our characters are going to be like, what sort of areas we talk about. Because the difficulty that we have is anyone that would have been here during the war wouldn't have talked at all about what they did. So although we as actors and as characters need to know what our job is, when we're interacting with each other and with the public as they come in, we can't tell them what we do. So I can't say to them what I do and how I do it. So it's going to be difficult to show what it is, what life is like on a daily basis without referring to the key reason that we're here. But over the rehearsal period, I suppose we'll find ways that we can hint to it, allude to it, but without outright saying anything.
There may be some opportunities within the idea that, of course, you talked amongst yourselves and your watch about what you were doing.
Yes.
But only with those people and only within the confines of that room, if you like.
Yes.
Classically, people in one room didn't know what was happening in the next one.
Exactly.
And the bomber ends didn't know they were phoning job up to a building just, you know, that you could almost reach out and touch. They could have been phoning anywhere in the world. That level of secrecy. But, of course, the social life thrived almost, I think, partly as a result of that, because they had to find other things to talk about with everybody else. So it all became on a very light note.
Well, yeah, I suppose if you think in modern days when people meet up on a Friday night to go for a drink after work, they talk about their jobs. If you take that away, everyone's going to be a lot lighter, probably, talking about everything else that's going on.
We talk about what's on the telly now, aren't we? You have a personal family connection. Tell me about your grandfather.
Well, my grandfather worked at Bletchley during the war. He was also stationed at Eastcote and Stanmore. He was the maintenance person for the bomb machines. They come every year to they have sort of a Bletchley reunion in September. And my parents always bring my grandparents up. And so they're very much a part of Bletchley life, and they always consider themselves a part of it. And that's why, you know, I felt I had to come here.
So you'd heard quite a lot about it in the family, and he's obviously got very fond memories then.
He does. I mean, he doesn't talk a lot about what he did. I think it's just that lingering thing that at the time they weren't allowed to talk about it, so even now he doesn't openly discuss what happened at Bletchley. But my grandmother always tells a great story about when he first told her, and she said that he came to her one day and said, "I have to tell you a secret that I've not been able to tell you for many years." And she thought, is it another family? Is it another wife? Does he have another child?
I didn't want to say that.
What could it be? And he said, I worked at Bletchley Park during the war. And she said, well, what's that? Yeah. She just didn't know.
This would have been about 1974, 75, I'm
exactly,
guessing.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's when he told her.
Have you talked to him about this job?
I have.
What does he make of it?
He was absolutely thrilled. Just when I said that I was auditioning here, he was really excited just at the thought that I'd be here at Bletchley. And over Christmas, we were all talking about it because I had the audition coming up. So for him, I think, as much as it's about Bletchley, the fact that I'm doing acting as well, which is something that, as I say, he always did as a hobby, I think he really likes the idea that I'm joining the two together. It's two things that were very big in his life, acting and Bletchley, and so to be able to marry the two, I think is as exciting for him as it is for me, really.
And it's wonderful because not many people get to kind of live on with the Bletchley story. I mean, we're very privileged doing this podcast and the rest of my job and being steeped in this story day to day, and you will be for a short time, and hopefully more will come of that. But not many people get to kind of live it the way that we do. And I think for him, you've joined the two things together. And it's the ultimate make your hobby your job acting, isn't it? If you can make a living out
Definitely.
Of it and not have to do other things and, you know, struggle and fit things around it. I really hope you continue with this success, and hopefully this will be quite good on your CV.
Oh, this will look fantastic on the CV, definitely. But also, as you say, being able to learn about Bletchley, about the life here and everything that went on. There are so many fascinating little stories that it's just been really interesting to learn about. And I really hope that during this project we can really bring the park to life, you know, bring that to the people who come and visit and try and show them what the life was like.
So
what's it like for you to bring these characters back to life and to have dress actors playing these kind of parts?
Exciting. It's really interesting sort of doing research about a place which is obviously very hidden and there's not a lot of resources, finding images and sort of getting the real people rather than just the look of the 1940s and World War II. obviously everyone's really close up, all the visitors, so yeah. And interacting with the
scrutiny.
Actors as well. So there is scrutiny.
You will expect people to come and right. say, uniform's not right. Well, it must be quite difficult to get uniforms right.
Well, I've hired uniforms from a company that most of the uniforms are actually original. So I think actually the two that they've sent me are originals. They specialise in original military wear and then have replicas if they don't have quite the right sizes. So yeah, it's about finding the right people to get it on. Yeah. But yeah, I think we've done quite well.
They look amazing. And so tell me about what you're going to do with the rest of their sort of modern look, their modern haircuts.
Yeah, we're going to have a little hair session this afternoon. And obviously we have the modern tools of hair tongs, which they didn't quite have in that day, so it makes it a lot quicker to achieve the hairstyles. I think I'm probably going to show them a few styles and then let them find their own sort of way of doing it, because it's not just about getting a 1940s look, it's about them and their characters and what they feel that they would
their
do with
their
day-to-day reality of doing with their hair and how much time they feel they would have to do. Yeah, exactly. And just make Vinny grow his hair faster.
Vinny.
Keep growing.
Civilian co-breaker Vinny. Well, you're going to have to instigate a side parting there, do you think?
Yeah, that's
got some Brill
quite
cream,
long.
See what we can do.
You'll still be wearing it in the summer, I think, if what I hear about Brill cream's true. I mean, you all look very authentic. It's very exciting.
I hope she will smile, feel recognised and proud. They're the words of Sarah Harding, director of the second two-part story in series two of the hit ITV drama The Bletchley Circle. After the dust had settled on the chaos of location filming here at Bletchley Park, Sarah came back for a proper look around and to investigate her very personal connection to the story. Sarah's mother was a Moore slip reader at Bletchley Park, giving her a real insight into the characters she was bringing to life on screen.
What's your first memory of hearing about or becoming aware of Bletchley Park?
Well, I first became aware of Bletchley Park in the 70s, just when everyone started talking about Enigma, and it all surfaced. When I was young, one of the first things I was taught was to spell my name in Morse code. And my mum used to tell me stories about how she was in signals during the war and taught me Morse. I thought no more of this. She's had a very exciting war. A few people would visit who she spent time with the war in. And then in the 70s, I actually watched a television play called The Imitation Game, which was set in Bletchley Park. And it was about a young woman codebreaker who met somebody who was based on Turing. Now, I knew nothing about these. And I said to my mother, is that anything like your war? And she said, well, I was actually there. I was at Bletchley, that's where I did my signals. And the name meant nothing to me, it meant nothing to anybody really. And then gradually, bit by bit, I just understood the tremendous importance of Bletchley Park and the scope of the work, what went on here. I don't know, as a girl you kind of dismiss anything that your parents do as a little bit dull or not very important. And, you know, she'd been a housewife and mother, lot like the women in the Bletchley Circle. And she came alive when she talked about the war. It was a focused, exciting thing to do. And bit by bit, I realised the significance of those eight-hour shifts and being bussed in and having to get every... She was in signals, having to listen to that Morse, having to focus the dials until you got it absolutely right and not make any error, just the concentration. So I started asking her about it. But I think it's hard if you've actually repressed a memory and not talked about it for so long. It's very difficult to remember the details because they were told to bury it, wipe it.
That's something we hear quite often here from veterans that say, I found it quite difficult, or I was horrified when I first heard people were talking about it. You know, and it would have taken maybe another 10 or 20 years. Some people said they let a little bit out and it felt like a thrill of wrongness, if you like, that they...
Yeah.
Did you see that in your mother, that yes. It was difficult for her?
Difficult, because the whole idea was not to speak about it. She said very little in the 70s, but gradually, you know, the Robert Harris book, it seems to be something that people are genuinely wanting to know more about.
More and more people talked about, spilled on their experience and didn't get into trouble. And so she probably gradually got reassured.
And then this year, the script for Bletchley Circle kind of lands on my desk without anyone knowing there's any connection.
And that's amazing.
Which is lovely, because obviously they want directors to direct, not to do it just because of a family connection. And it was like two sides coming together, really. And one of the lovely things was, and when I was researching that, I went to a talk given one of your veterans in Devon. It was a very good talk. It was about, you know, the whole process of code breaking. And I went up to him and said, well, my mother says she's at Bletchley Park. How do I find out more about that? And he said, oh, well, you know, have you looked on the Roll of Honour? So I said, no, what's that? And gave me the website. And there was a real thrill, because there she was, Dorothy Mary Thompson, you know, married as a Harding. And it did say exactly what she'd said, 43 to 45. That's been when she was 20 to 22, incredibly formative time of your life. Mm. You know, a young woman who'd actually left school at 15. She wasn't a clever university codebreaker. No, I always thought everybody at Bletchley Park was Oxbridge, very clever mathematicians. And then I've now realised that although a lot of very bright women here, a lot of the skills are absolute accuracy, tenaciousness, focus. And one of the things, apart from the Morse, that my mother always did was play the piano. She spent a lot of time playing piano duets or singing alto in choir. And I realised that that's the other thread, the musical ear. So that when you are listening to a crackling signal with your headphones, you can pick out, if you like, the inner parts. So
I've heard that they would recognise certain transmitters, operators, and that they would hear a voice within
that. Was definitely, she said, yes, I knew that was somebody. They were certainly from quite a long way away. She did say, I could recognise his, you know, his imprint, the thumb.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And yes, she could really
tell
if it was
this. Uniform and so rigid, that to have that individual voice within it, that's real. Close listening, isn't
it? It's close listening, but it's also that musical thing of rhythm, you know, complex rhythms, and the way somebody would do, you know, a dotted rhythm in music is done differently. It's like if you listen to a violinist, you can tell it's that person and not that person. But
so with you as a child, she's teaching you to write your name in Morse, and she's teaching you about Morse. So it must have stayed with her inside her head in a way, that rhythm, that sound.
That sound, yes, yes. And we play piano duets, which is also about listening and receiving.
Mm.
I think one of the things, you know, music was almost a thread, or using your ear. And I also remember, though, it was a bit annoying, irritating, that if somebody was too noisy, certainly as she got... She's 91 now, but the ear is very good, but too much noise, if you can't separate it, is very difficult. You know, if you've got a very sensitive ear, it's a great skill, but it's also a bit of a curse, because we live in a world where they're just bombarded with sound. And that's not very pleasant.
And you can close your eyes, but you can't close your ears.
No, you can't, actually. But when I went to the Roll of Honour and looked at it, someone said, well, of course, you can. There's a badge and there's a certificate. So just after her 90th birthday, I did the application. And this year, the badge came and the certificate came. And she said, well, what's all this about? I didn't do anything, in that classic self-deprecating way that people do. You know, and I said, well, actually, it says, you know, David Cameron thanks you for the war effort. And I read the citation out to her.
You did do this, yeah.
You did do this. And, you know, you haven't just been a housewife and mother. You have contributed this, because everybody's skills counted. Everybody was part of it. And nobody could... there wasn't room for error. It, you know, it was military, it was precise. And, I mean, she had a year of training. She was told, you know, do you want to be a cook or, you know, signals, because she wasn't trained. And she chose signals. And for a whole year, she said, she'd go to a GPO, a signals training course. There's one in Edinburgh, one in Morecambe. And everyone else got deployed, and she moved to the next one. And she said, I got a bit fed up after 9 months of training pay because I didn't get a job and I kept getting moved on. And this was really her first job, because obviously whatever skill she had was a skill they were looking for in terms of kind of accurate Morse transcriptions.
I still find it fascinating, all these people who don't know why they were picked.
Yeah, you don't know why. What it is about me, why, you know, they went off to...
And they don't know now, even. She's at 91 and got her badge and everything, yeah, but she still doesn't know what really brought her here, what it was that someone saw in her.
It's a sense of, yeah, it's what exactly what is being, you know, she didn't have any particular game plan of life, but this skill was recognised.
Well, that's very apt for the story of the Bletchley Circle. These women, in the first series, which was set up beautifully, and I'm sure in the second series as well, that they are left somewhat adrift after the war. That they have been picked out as special somehow, and that their specialness was very important and it was used to great effect and to great success during the war. But then suddenly, it's almost like everybody who had an important war job was almost dropped into the great sort of pool of society, and off you go, get on with it.
And also,
what next? What do you do? And you can't say anything, you can't use it.
Yeah. And also, off you go, and please, can you make nice homes for the men who are coming home because they need the jobs? You know, you can't build on it. It was almost as... So it hadn't happened, wasn't it?
And devalues their contribution at that time. That's what it must have felt like. And that feeling came across beautifully in there.
Yeah.
Did that appeal to you as something to
Oh, very much. I'm very, very much so. I mean, I'm really conscious that that generation really had a tough time because, you know, those women found themselves in the war. They used their brains. They gave a lot. They had a sense of, you know, value. And a sense of intellectual...
They had to dig deep as well.
They had to dig deep, and it wasn't expected. They weren't brought up to do this.
And to be the very best and better than they could have imagined they could do all of a sudden, and it's really, really important.
And then not only it's not celebrated, it's as though they can turn off their intellect and just go to, wouldn't you really like to bake cakes? Wouldn't you like to go and have this housewife life? And I think she watched my generation of women... say, well, it's our right to have careers, it's our right to use our brain, because we had the Education Act, we were, you know, we had scholarships to go to university. And it must have been very difficult knowing what they did, not being able to share it, but watching their daughters, if you like, reap the benefits. I think Bletchley Circle's a real gift to those women, because it's actually valuing what they did. And, okay, it's an ITV drama, it's a thriller, but it's exciting. It's like they come alive again when they connect.
Drama, though, can tell that kind of emotional story a lot more strongly than documentary can. Documentaries can be very powerful and evocative, and they can be quite emotional, but if you connect with a character, it's a very different way of being spoken to about an idea or a feeling.
And it's not just about, I mean, it is about Bletchley Park, but it's also about what happened to that generation of women, what society did to them. You know, instead of recognising their skills, they were just told to go back to their pigeonholes, really.
So what did you think when you read the script when it landed on your desk?
Well, I'd seen the first series and I thought it's very exciting and it was beautifully done and I was just thrilled to be asked to be a part of it. But I got very involved in it, especially as a mother and daughter theme, which was quite interesting. And I was very keen on doing a drama, which was about watching women think. And even in the staging of it, you know, you've got the old Sex in the City where women go out for coffee and they look at each other and they clink their glasses and they're always talking about men. It's just, this was, even when they talked, you could see they were in their heads, they were problem solving. So in the episodes I did, often they're not meeting each other's eyes. You can see their minds working. They're not trying to please each other. They're on a mission, they're on a task. Each character's skill, I was very keen that we brought that out. Like Millie is a linguist, and actually without her language skills, they couldn't have solved the problems that they have. So we worked with a language expert to try and make sure she was interpreting, she was using the skills she had at Bletchley. One of the characters is an engineer, so you actually see her using those skills to mend an Enigma machine, and she actually gets her hands dirty. Another one, who has the eidetic memory, Lucy, remembers key codes. So you actually see them, those skills being valued, those skills being useful. And they're not just slapping themselves on the back, they're rolling up their sleeves and getting on with it. So even though you almost wanted to create a wartime atmosphere in peacetime.
It's got that lovely appealing notion as well of they know something that the people around them don't know, so you know something that the other characters don't know. And that's a very effective tool in drama, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you've got a secret world, if you like.
And you're invited in as an audience. You're invited in to share that secret world. We have this wonderful designer, Claire Kenny, who created the kind of back room of a library, which becomes the secret world. And when they're there, they can truly be themselves. And you just have odd encounters. One goes for an interview where they're patronised, and you know, she's trying to get a job as a secretary, and she's been, you know, a highly skilled worker at Bletchley Park, and they're asking all these inappropriate questions. Also, she has baggage in this series. But once they go outside this haven of a library, they're treated in completely different ways. There's a lot of eye-rolling. They just have to bite their lip and let them get on with it. And at the end, because the women, through many twists and turns, obviously do start solving the problem and getting justice to be done. But even then, in the final scene, they have to hold back. They cannot be where the action is happening, because although they have instigated the action, they have to be in a back alley, because they don't have the clout that police and customs and the army have.
They have to send the boys in.
They have to send the boys in. And there's a wonderful bit that Rachel Sterling as Millie does, where she just says, we know this is wrong, but you've got to do this because we need someone stronger. And she's not saying it to persuade him. She's saying it because she's angry that she hasn't got the power to do it. There's that moment they all get to where they've solved it intellectually. Then they have to go through this manoeuvre to get somebody to believe in them, because they won't believe in four housewives. And there's areas of frustration. They can't pat themselves on the back like Hercule Poirot and kind of do a big speech about how clever they are. Only they know that within them, within their circle. That's one of the reasons I do drama, is to just, you know, get people feeling, talking and thinking about their lives in a different way. And for Bletchley Circle, it's thinking about, for me, very much, it's the legacy of what our post-war generation of women could, you know, have had, the opportunities we've had, and how tricky it was for them to come from a world of, you know, where women couldn't get mortgages, weren't expected to, you know, stay in work if they were married. The strides.
Suppressed, yeah.
Very suppressed.
What do you hope your mother will say when she's watched this series? What do you expect her to say? Are they two different things?
I just hope she'll smile. I hope it will just make her feel recognised. I'm proud.
Michael Portillo has described the blanket of secrecy which was rolled out across the nation during World War II as fundamentally important. I grabbed a chat with him between takes when he was here filming Great British Railway Journeys. This chat cost him his lunch, as by the time we'd finished, the TV crew had snaffled all the sandwiches. But he was a complete gentleman about it. Was this your first visit to Bletchley Park?
Yes, first time here. I should have been years ago, because I'm really very interested in the subject. But as has quite often happened to me, my first visit to important places is when I come here filming Great British Railway Journeys, which has taken me all over Britain and now even all over Europe, discovering fascinating places.
You're quite often in museums and heritage sites. You must get to dip a toe in some really fascinating stories.
It's an immense privilege to present this programme, as I get an inside track on all sorts of things and have the great honour, really, of then presenting that to the public. I am in many museums, although museums don't always make good television because they're rather static things. And, of course, making these railway journeys, it's largely about motion. So we use museums a little bit sparingly. But, of course, coming here and being able to see the Enigma machine or the bomb machine, I mean, these are very dynamic things in themselves. You know, you can open them up and you can look at them and you can think about how they work. And so they're very, very appealing to television audiences.
It's the sort of thing that you can't really understand in abstract. It's something that is very visual, isn't it? It's a completely different way of absorbing the story and the complexity of it when you can see these things in motion.
Yes. The machines are so complicated that unless you see the moving parts, there literally are moving parts in the Enigma machine, in the bomb machine, then it's difficult to understand. Of course, it then requires a good explanation. I've certainly had a very good explanation today. But even so, let's face it, there is a chasm between the understanding of the average person and the level of genius activity that went on here during the war.
You've clearly done your homework about what happened here and how things work, but has coming here sort of changed your impression of what happened? I mean, usually I find most people come and they're stunned by the scale of it and the depth of the secrecy.
I think I knew a lot about the depth of the secrecy because I've met quite a lot of people who were involved in such secret projects during the war, and what is impressive about them is that they still don't want to talk about what they did, even though, by and large, they're allowed to. Of course, because I was once Defence Secretary, I lived in a very secret environment myself and was subject to, and am subject to, the Official Secrets Act. But, yes, I think its physical extent is impressive. The fact that there were, you know, more than 10,000 people working here is impressive. And I think I have understood more what was the challenge facing the code breakers by being here than I had understood before. Or perhaps in particular, I've understood more about how it was they were able to begin to break down the codes, looking for patterns of language and repetitions of language in German messages, which is very, very intriguing. And, you know, one is just so admiring of the work that was done.
And, of course, talking to Betty, you hit upon the other layer of complexity, which was the outward-going information that we got from the decoded messages we then had to disguise, and there's a whole other layer of deception. That's fascinating, isn't it?
It is fascinating. Obviously, because we were breaking other people's codes, we realised that repetition was a vulnerability. That if you were using the same words, the same phrases repeatedly, then you were opening yourself up to having your codes broken. So one of the things that Betty Webb was doing towards the end of the war, I think, was taking messages that had been translated from Japanese, which then had to be passed on, but avoiding a repetition. So she was having to paraphrase those messages in English so that the meaning was absolutely the same, but the phrasing was absolutely different. And somehow this young girl, she came here when she was 18, had this particular knack for paraphrasing, which was a vital skill during the war.
And she's an embodiment of that culture of secrecy that, like you say, you've experienced in your former career. I think we think we've got full disclosure in Britain today and around the world and with the internet and the media as it is, but we don't. There are things that we don't know, and we're better off not knowing, aren't we?
I jolly well hope there are things that aren't known. People still approach me to give interviews about, for instance, the nuclear deterrent, and there are things that I would refuse to talk about. I mean, it's just not helpful, and it's not permitted, it's not legal for me to talk about some of those things. So yes, of course, there is still immense secrecy in our intelligence services and in our Ministry of Defence, and there has to be. But thinking about an operation the size of Bletchley Park during World War II, one does have this worry about whether, in an emergency, we could enlist a population that has now become very accustomed to indiscretion, whether we could enlist them to acquire the culture of secrecy that was fundamentally important to winning World War II.
I think people failed to grasp that it was all-pervading and that everybody was involved in the war effort one way or another.
Yes, and World War II, I think, is an interesting study in how to create a culture, because this culture was created overnight and across the country, so that it was all about, you know, drawing your blinds and not spreading rumours, and not talking about what you did. I mean, even if you were working in a factory, it was important not to talk about what you did. And so this blanket of secrecy was rolled out across the nation. And obviously during World War II, we had this sense of shared endeavour. It was a fight for survival. And so people could be recruited into that culture of secrecy. There was nothing unnecessary about it or bureaucratic about it. It was fundamentally important.
And that brings us to Betty, who over tea and those little finger sandwiches told Michael Portillo and all the programme's viewers about her war work at Bletchley Park. Here she is talking to author and researcher Kerry Howard.
I'm here with Charlotte Webb, Charlotte Vinesey Stevens, as she was back in World War II. Would you like to tell us how you came to be at Bletchley Park?
Well, yes, I was at a domestic science college called Radbrook near Shrewsbury, and of course, we were listening in to the reports of the war, which was pretty awful because London had been bombed since 1940-41. And three or four of us decided that we were really wasting our time doing domestic science when we really ought to be doing something towards the war effort. So we left in the middle midterm, which must have been a bit annoying for our parents, and joined the ATS, the Auxiliary Territorial Service.
How old were you at this point?
I was just coming up to 18 and hadn't been about in the world very much, and suddenly find myself doing army training in Wrexham. After that was finished, I think because I put on my CV that I spoke German, I was sent up to London to an interview, which was actually in German. And after about half an hour or so, the intelligence officer who'd interviewed me said, right, here's a railway warrant, go to Euston and get on a train for Bletchley. Well, Bletchley at that time meant absolutely nothing to me. I didn't know where it was or what its role was in the war. However, I soon found out, because the first thing I had to do after a night in the civilian billet in Bradwell, I went down to the mansion and was given the Official Secrets Act to read and sign. Now, the Official Secrets Act is a fairly formidable document, especially when you're only 18, and I was quite frightened and wondered how I was going to comply with the rules, which were that you didn't speak about anything that you read or saw or heard for the whole of your time there and for 30 years afterwards. So it was rather a baptism of fire, I suppose you could call it. However, I told myself that that's how it is and that's what you must do. Keep everything to yourself.
So were you in the mansion when you signed this?
Yes, yes, in the mansion, in a little room just on the left of the entrance hall. And there sat an army officer with a gun on the table and, as I said earlier, the copy of the Official Secrets Act.
And did they give you plenty of time to read through this formidable document?
I think so, yes. I don't remember being rushed. No, I was able to quietly take it in.
And he was sat there with a gun on the table. That must have been quite intimidating.
Well, yes, it was really, but I suppose in retrospect that was how it was in those days. Any member of the armed forces would, men mainly, would have a gun anyway. That's how I see it.
So you signed this document and then were you taken straight to your place of work?
Yes, I was. And it was to work with Major Ralph Tester, who was a very senior member of the Government Codes and Cipher School staff. And he had rooms actually in the mansion where we sat and registered the messages as they came in. It was a fairly boring task, but a very important one, because it had to be done in such a way that the messages could be called for in either date order or subject order by the code breakers.
So these messages came in from dispatch riders or over the teleprinter?
Right. That's
right. So they had not yet been deciphered?
No, no, they were in Morse code, either five-figure groups or of letters or figures. There's nothing on them to say where they'd come from. All that was on them that was in clear was the date.
So you registered them and then they went on their way, but you were never told where they went?
No, we were never told where they went, no.
Did you do that for the entire war or did you change roles?
No, I had lots of odd jobs to do. Sometimes there was typing to be done. And then my most interesting job was when I was transferred to the Japanese section to do paraphrasing of translated Japanese messages.
So run us through exactly sort of, you know, what you went through. What you received this message that had been deciphered?
It had been deciphered and translated. So what I saw was English, but it was mostly from the Burmese border with India.
And the purpose of you providing these paraphrasings, what was that all about?
Well, that was so that they could be transferred to our military personnel in Burma in disguise. I never actually knew where they went. I just did my job and put them into two envelopes. The first envelope had an address and the outer envelope had another address, which wasn't the same. And I don't know and I will never know where they went to.
And of course, it didn't stop there for you. When the war finished in Europe, your sort of paraphrasing of Japanese messages continued, didn't it? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Oh, yes, it did. It was a complete surprise because a number of us, myself included, were due to go to Delhi. Anyway, suddenly that whole exercise was cancelled, and I was chosen out of, I suppose, quite a few others, and I don't know why, but my boss called me in and said, sorry you're not going to Delhi, but you are going to Washington, D.C., and to work in the Pentagon with the British community there.
And tell us about your first day in the Pentagon, what it felt like. How did you get there? What did it feel like? And what was it sort of like inside? Because at that point, it was quite new, wasn't it?
Oh, it was absolutely new and a very, very large building, the like of which I'd never seen before. And I was taken down by my English boss from the Cairo Hotel in Washington, where we were accommodated. And we went down by bus. It was a shuttle bus which went in and out of Washington all the time with workers. And we were taken into Colonel O'Connor's office. He was the American colonel in charge of that particular department. And then I was put to work doing my paraphrasing again.
And was there a lot of security around the building?
Tremendous lot of security, yes. We had special passes. And in addition to the first one from the entrance into the various floors of the Pentagon, there was another security check outside our individual office. A girl who was a member of the American Women's Army Corps, she sat at a desk with details of us with a photograph, and every time we went in and out, she had to check us.
And am I right that there was around 30,000 people working there?
Absolutely right. 32,000 for lunch.
Everything must have been on an enormous scale.
Indeed, it was. And the Pentagon is enormous. Absolutely enormous. Even the centrepiece, I believe I'm right in saying, it was something like 8 acres. And when General Eisenhower had finished his duties in Europe, he came back to America and came to see us in the Pentagon in this quadrangle. He came in a tank with an entourage of soldiers and other vehicles, and we were able to see him at close quarters.
What was sort of the temperature like? You know, we hear stories about how cold it was at Bletchley, sort of working in the huts and things, and it must have been quite different sort of working in Washington,
Washington
at that sort of time.
That's right. Washington in the summer could be very, very hot indeed, and with a very high rate of humidity. So we didn't wear our khaki uniforms. We were issued with the Canadian summer uniform, which relieved the situation a bit. But in those days, we're talking about the 40s, very few buildings had air conditioning. The Pentagon did, but actually that was quite a shock to the body. As you went in, you felt the sudden blast of cold. It was almost as bad as a blast of hot air. But you get used to that sort of thing.
So you were at the Pentagon between sort of May and when did you come back?
Well, we couldn't get a passage back until October, but the actual...
And this was 1945.
We're talking about 1945, yes. The atomic bomb, which was dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, was dropped on, I think it was August the 8th. But anyway, that was the end of the war, of course. But we had to wait for transport home. So it was early October before I finally left Washington for New York, where we had to wait about for the Aquitania, which had been a troop ship during the war. And I spent 3 very wet days in New York waiting to get on the boat.
But I bet you were able to bring a few things back that you couldn't get in
England. Oh, absolutely. I mean, shopping in Washington and New York after the privations of England were absolutely wonderful. We were able to buy clothes and anything else we wanted, really.
So you were a bit loaded down when you came back?
Absolutely loaded down. I had 4 cases, 2 kit bags and 2 other cases which I'd bought. And because the stevedores were on strike, I had to carry the lot. So it was 1 under each arm and 1 in each hand. Yeah, but it was a very rough crossing, actually. Very rough indeed. And it took about 4 days to get back to England.
Now, I know when you came back, you went back to Bletchley, but before we sort of talk about Bletchley at the end of the war. Let's talk about what it was like while you were there. When you were working in the mansion, can you tell us a little bit about your office, what it looked like, what sort of equipment you had in there?
Oh, well, in the mansion itself, it was just a pokey little room, which I would suggest had been servants' quarters in the days when the mansion was a private dwelling. Nothing very spectacular. We had one window which looked out onto Hut 4, and the other offices which Major Tester occupied were equally uninteresting, just as I say, I should think. Servants' quarters in the old days.
So they were quite simple, just sort of a desk, very your index simple. Cards.
Oh yes, nothing else. There was a fireplace in one of the rooms, because there was no central heating. We had open fires sometimes. No, it was not very remarkable. But Block F, that was built during the time I was there and to which I was transferred, was relatively comfortable. It was brick. And there was some central heating in that. But again, I mean, the offices were very bare, a few typewriters about in some of them, and trestle tables, very hard, uncomfortable chairs to sit on, and, of course, piles of paper everywhere.
Like my office. So we know that at the peak there were nearly 9,000 people working at Bletchley and the outstations. Did you feel that there was a lot of people there? You know, was there always people milling around?
Yes, that's true. But I don't think we ever had occasion to really think about it or question why, because with this secrecy atmosphere hanging around, you didn't ask questions and you couldn't go into anybody else's hut. The only people who could go into the huts were those who were employed there. And you didn't know what went on in any of the huts because they were only numbered. They were not named in any way. We didn't know whether they were Navy, Army or Air Force or whatever. But there were a lot of people milling around. We were all free to go into the mansion for coffee after lunch, duties permitting, and mixed bag of folks with whom you chatted. You didn't necessarily know them or know what they were doing.
And what about getting around on the site and around Bletchley and where you were billeted, Loughton at this point?
Yes, that's right. Well, there was a very adequate bus service organised for the, especially if you were on shift work. I don't think there were any public buses. These were all arranged by Bletchley itself. And some of us had bicycles. Mine actually got pinched. And when I asked the military police if they could look for it for me, they said, well, yes, but can we have a description? I said, well, it's just a basic bicycle. It doesn't have a bell. It doesn't have a saddlebag or anything like that. And I think the military police rather gave up.
And this was at Bletchley that it got pinched?
That's right, actually in the park.
Perhaps it's one of the ones that are now on display. It's been discovered.
Exactly. I have looked, but I don't recognise it. The tyres are rather flat now anyway.
I bet. So you came back to Bletchley after you were in Washington?
Yes, that's right, but only very briefly, and of course it was all being run down.
So it would have been a very different atmosphere at that
very,
point.
Oh, a very different atmosphere, rather, the end of a party atmosphere. There was nothing much to be done, apart from those who'd been given the job of destroying everything. So I was only there for a few days, and I was posted down to wait for my demob group. I went down to somewhere in Sussex.
And what would you say is your most strong memory of your time at Bletchley?
Well, I think apart from the social life, which was very good, paraphrasing the Japanese messages, that was really interesting. And we had a very good social life. Pretty well everything was laid on in the way of concerts, plays, sport, and recreation. So we had a very balanced life.
And did you meet any lifelong friends?
I did indeed, yes. Although I didn't meet the main one in Bletchley. She had been there, but she was also in Washington. And she was the daughter of Commander Denniston. And we remained friends for quite a long time. And actually, there was one member of the Wrens who had been at Radbrook, at the Domestic Science College with me. And I didn't know she was going to join up, and she turned up there, but was billeted at Woburn Abbey, so I didn't see very much of her.
And it must have been a great time to be able to talk about your work together, you know, later once the veil of secrecy...
Yes, but, you know, funnily enough, we didn't, somehow. We talked about the social side of it, but we didn't talk about our work.
So do you say you found it quite hard to talk about your work after
yes,
all that?
Yes, I am. I never felt at ease, even after the veil of secrecy was lifted in 1975. I had no wish to talk about it then, as I believe is the case with many others. It wasn't until about 1994 that I was encouraged to think about giving talks about Bletchley generally, and then I began to open up, but it's been quite difficult over the years.
And after over 100 talks, you can talk about it quite openly now.
Oh, that's right. I don't have any problems now.
Thank you, Betty. Thank you for taking the time to speak today.
Thank you for being interested.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.